Hello, my name is Todd Baginski. I am the Vice President of Mobility and SharePoint Solutions at Canvas LLC. My team and I built the property management code sample for Microsoft. This is part one in a two-part video series which walks you through how we provisioned all of the components that make up the property management code sample. Okay, let's get started. First, I'd like to provide you with a brief introduction of all the different Office 365 technologies that the property management code sample interacts with and things that we provision in the sample. We work with SharePoint Sites, Office 365 Unified Groups, Workflows, Exchange, OneDrive, the Office 365 Video Portal, and OneNote. You can get all the code for the Office 365 web app, as well as the different mobile applications, at the URL you see here in the slide deck. All of the provisioning code that is part of the code sample exists within the Office 365 web app. Before I start digging into the code, I'd like to take a moment to help you understand what the remote provisioning pattern is and how the property management code sample aligns with the remote provisioning pattern. Essentially, remote provisioning is using any combination of SharePoint, Office 365, and Graph APIs to create and configure SharePoint and Office 365 components. You can learn more about the remote provisioning pattern in the Office Dev P&P Guidance repo. In particular, the article that you see linked here on the screen, the SharePoint Add-in Recipe for Site Provisioning, helps you get started with remote provisioning. This is what the article looks like. As you can see, it's a very lengthy article which walks you through all the different patterns you can use to remotely provision site collections and subsites in SharePoint. The property management code sample goes well above and beyond the examples shown in the article that I just showed you. This is stage one of the remote provisioning that takes place in the property management code sample. I'm going to walk you through all the different pieces of this puzzle. The only one that has overlap here with the article that I showed you in the Office Dev repository is the create site collection process. But as we deploy all the components and remotely provision everything associated with the property management code sample, it's a much larger process. Many more things are deployed. In stage one of our remote provisioning process, which you see on this slide, we're basically creating the SharePoint site foundation that serves as the basis for where we store many documents and list items and how we work with our workflows inside of the property management code sample. We're going to start by authenticating with the global administrator credentials. Then we are going to establish a context to the admin site associated with our tenancy. Once we have established that context, we will create the site collection used in the sample, and we will set the owner for that site collection. At this point, we're going to establish a new client context for the private site collection we just created. After we've done so, we can create the information architecture in the private site collection. This includes creating site columns, content types, lists, and binding our lookup fields to our lists. After the information architecture has been provisioned, we'll then move forward and create our workflows. We will provision our workflow definitions, we will create the workflow task list and the workflow history list, and then we will subscribe and configure the workflow to the SharePoint list that it needs to work with. At this point, creating our SharePoint site foundation is complete, and we move on to stage two of the remote provisioning. In stage two of the remote provisioning, we are going to create list items in those lists that we created in the SharePoint private site collection. We're going to make list items in the properties, rooms, inspections, inspection comments, and incidents lists. This is essentially seeding the demo with data so that when you load it for the first time, you can use it and see all of the functionality the sample has to offer. We also need to upload documents to accomplish that same goal. First, we will upload documents to the room inspection photos document library, then the repair photos document library, and then finally the property photos document library. Notice the box around all of these items here indicates that we are using the SharePoint Private Site Collection context to allow us to authenticate and perform these operations. After that, we will provision videos to the Office 365 video portal. First, we'll create a channel for the videos associated with the incidents that are reported. Then we will create a video file placeholder, which essentially creates the metadata about a video. And then we will upload the actual video and associate it with that file placeholder in the Office 365 video portal. Again, we will use the private site collections context. We will go back and we will update list items. And to do that, we are going to query some list items that we need to update, and then we will update their dates. As you will see, this allows us to dial in the sample so that you can run it anytime you want and set it to dates that are current to when you are running that sample, so that all of the workflows and reminders and everything associated with Outlook and calendaring will be applicable to the time that you're running the sample. After the list items have been updated, it's time to provision the Azure Active Directory groups and users. To do this, first we will create AAD groups, and then we will create AAD users. We will assign licenses to the users, add the users to the AAD groups, and then we'll loop back and add the users to the SharePoint groups to give those users permission to access the SharePoint site that we provisioned in stage one. Finally, we will work with Office 365 groups to provision them. We will create the Office 365 groups, add the owners to the groups, and then we will add the members to the groups so that the different users can access those groups accordingly. As you can see, there are many different things that we are provisioning here. There are actually 36 different things that we are provisioning in Office 365 as part of this sample, which makes it an excellent reference and learning opportunity as you build your own applications inside of Office 365. Now I'm going to start digging into each one of these individual steps to show you how it is initiated and the code behind it that actually does the remote provisioning. So at the very beginning, you can see here in the slide, I have it color-coded in black to indicate the current step. To begin and start the provisioning process, after you have installed the property management code sample, you'll navigate to the Office 365 app URL where you have installed it. That could be localhost, or in the case that I have here, you can see I have an Azure website where I've installed the sample. You navigate to the O365 site provisioning URL, which correlates to the O365 site provisioning controller within the application. You can see that indicated in the right. When you click the Create Demo Site Collection, that initiates the provisioning process. Now let's jump into Visual Studio to see the code associated with this web page and how we kick off the provisioning process. The index.cshtml file that you can see I have open here in the Views O365 Site Provisioning folder correlates to the web page we were just looking at in the previous slide. Notice the button to kick off the site provisioning for the Create Demo Site Collection is named BTN Site Provisioning, and its click event fires the Start Site Provisioning function. This function is going to make a post to the Start Site Provisioning method inside of the O365 Site Provisioning Controller class. So here's my Controller class, and here is the Start Site Provisioning method. So that's really how everything starts. This is your entry point into the entire provisioning process. Before I dig into it in more detail, though, I'm going to loop back and talk a little bit about authentication, and then we'll come back here and talk about how we create the private site collection. So the first thing we need to understand is authentication associated with the provisioning process. That's this step we have in the diagram here. A user is going to authenticate to the web app with the global administrator credentials associated with this tenancy. We need them to use the global administrator credentials so that they have the permissions to actually create a new site collection. After the user is logged in with the global administrator credentials, we need to establish the admin site collection context. How do we do that? Well, the Authentication Helper class is used throughout the sample. The Authentication Helper class handles authentication to SharePoint, Outlook, and Graph services. It's used for more than just remote provisioning. It is also used as you actually run the sample and do things within the web app that require authentication to SharePoint, Outlook, and Graph services. The authentication helper has been designed to be portable and generic. It allows you to return a SharePoint client context associated with the admin site by calling the get admin site client context async method. The authentication helper class also returns access tokens for Outlook and Graph services. You can call the get Graph service async or the get Outlook service async to retrieve those access tokens. Let's jump into Visual Studio and take a closer look at the Authentication Helper class. The Authentication Helper class is found in the Utils folder right here. Notice the get admin site client context async method. This is the one I talked about that we're going to invoke to give us back the client context associated with the admin site in our tenancy. This method calls into the get SharePoint client context async method that you see right here below. We have to pass in the resource and the target URL associated with the SharePoint site in order to establish that client context. Notice these values come from our App Settings section. So if I navigate to the App Settings section of the app, here you can see this is our App Settings CS class. The App Settings CS class is basically referencing values in our web config. So we have a whole bunch of different things in here that, as you saw as you set this sample up, you configure these settings and dial it in for your individual tenancy. This allows this solution to be portable and easily installed in any Office 365 tenancy. If we take a look at the web config, we can see the different values here that correlate to these particular app settings. Heading back to the Authentication Helper class now, we understand where we got these values from. And you can see we're calling into the get SharePoint client context async method right here below. This particular method here returns first our access token for the resource we're trying to access, and then establishes the client context for the particular SharePoint site we wish to access and returns it. This particular method here is also used to return the client context object associated with the demo site collection as well. Notice inside this method, we call into the authentication helper's get access token async method, and we pass in the resource we wish to authenticate to. If we take a closer look at this particular method, get access token async, we can see that there's a couple different steps we need to do here in order to return the access token. The first thing we're going to do is create a new client credential based on the client ID and the app key that come from our AAD App Settings class. We haven't taken a look at that class yet, so let's take a look at it now. You can see inside of the AAD App Settings class, here we have all the different constants that allow us to define all of the different resource URLs and IDs that we're going to use as we use many different APIs to do our remote provisioning process. The client ID and the app key are the ones that correlate to our Azure Active Directory application that was created when we set up the sample. You can learn more about that in the README file on how Visual Studio will automatically create that Azure Active Directory application and give it the permissions that you specify in the Add Connected Services wizard. Returning to the authentication helper here, you can see that these are used to establish our client credential. The next thing we need to do is create our user object ID. We're going to pluck this user object ID off of the claims principle by using this particular string here to locate that value. After we have the user object ID, we need to get the user identifier, and that is done by making a new user identifier, passing in the user object ID, and telling it that we would like a user identifier type of unique ID to be returned during token acquisition. Now we're ready to go and get the context. So to get our authentication context, we have this method. The get authentication context method returns an authentication context. To create the authentication context, first we need to pluck the tenant ID from the claim for the currently logged in user. And that is done in line 122 right here. The next thing we need to do is we need to format a string to represent the authority, which is the AAD app setting authorization URI combined with the tenant ID. After we've done that, we then can go get the user's sign-in ID from their claim. And now that we have the sign-in ID, we can create a new naive session cache and pass in that user's sign-in ID. You can learn more about the naive session cache if you go look on the MSDN. The naive session cache, in a nutshell, is being intelligent for us, and it is caching the tokens for users locally, so we only have to go get them once, and then we return to the session cache to use them on subsequent requests. After we have the token cache established, and we have our authority established, now we can return our new authentication context. Once we have returned the authentication context, we then can call the acquire token silent async method on that particular authentication context. We pass in our resource, the client credential, and the user identifier that we have assembled in the earlier parts of this particular method. Now we can return the access token asynchronously. Once we have that access token, then we are able to establish the SharePoint client context with the rest of the code that you see here. So that is basically our flow on how we get the SharePoint client context for the admin site. Now that we have the admin site client context available, we can move forward and create the private site collection in this tenancy. To create the site collection, as I mentioned, that's the next piece of our puzzle. We need to create the private site collection that we'll use in the sample, and we need to set the site collection owner. Creating the private site collection happens in the siteprovisioning.cs file. The siteprovisioning.cs class contains all the operations related to site provisioning and configuration. You'll see me reference it several times in this two-part video series. The csomutil.cs file contains all the operations that use the SharePoint CSOM. We also use the CSOM a whole lot throughout the sample, and you'll see that referenced many times as well. Inside the siteprovisioning.cs class, the createSiteCollection method is going to call the getSiteCollectionStatusByURL method to periodically check the status of the site collection creation operation and proceed accordingly. The site collection owner is also set at the point where we create the site collection. So let's jump into the code and actually see how we create the private site collection. Now let's jump back into Visual Studio and see all the code that I just talked about. So we're going to start at the beginning of the O365 site provisioning controller on the index page. And as I mentioned, our authentication helper is used to establish the admin client context and the demo site that we're about to create client context via the authentication helper. So that's the first thing we do. After we do that, then we put the client context into our temp data dictionary so we can retrieve those client contexts very easily in the future. The next thing we're going to do is we're going to check our site provisioning task. And if it's not null and it hasn't been completed, then we're going to put into the view bag the fact that site provisioning is in progress. And so the first time through, this is going to be true because these values have not been created yet. When the user clicks the button to create the new demo site collection, as I mentioned before, the start site provisioning method is invoked. First, we're going to check to see if our site provisioning task is null and if that task has been completed. At this point, it is going to be null and it will not be completed because we haven't marked those values as such in our provisioning process. We're going to create a new site provisioning task. If we take a quick look at this particular class, we can see that we have a task, a message, and a phase, which allows us to track our site provisioning. So we'll create a new one of those, and then we will create a new task for it, and we will then instantiate a new site provisioning class. So here you can see our site provisioning class, and we are passing in from our temp data dictionary that demo site client context. That'll be null at this point in time. The next thing we're going to do is set the phase for our site provisioning task. And we call it, in this phase, provision site collection because that's exactly what we're doing. Then we start a while loop, which allows us to provision the site collection and check the status of that site collection periodically so that we can wait until it's finished before we provision the information architecture. So the next thing that we do now is we create the admin client context because we need that client context to create the private site collection. Again, we retrieve the client context from our temp data dictionary to create this client context. We're now going to set the message for our site provisioning task. And this message will then be displayed on the web page as this operation takes place. This is the message you saw if you've already provisioned the sample, which says the demo site collection is being created. This operation can take up to 20 minutes to complete. Please be patient and do not refresh the page during this process. After we set that message, now we attempt to create the site collection. So in our site provisioning class, we call the create site collection method and we pass in our admin client context. The create site collection method you see here uses the CSOM util get site collection status by URL method. I'm not going to dig into this one because essentially it's very easy to see what it does. It essentially just tells you the status of the site collection you're trying to create at this point in time. If Office 365 CSOM returns active, then we know we are creating that site collection. It's not done. Pardon me. If it returns active, it means we have already created that particular site collection and it is done. If it returns creating, we know that we are still in the midst of creating it. And if it returns none, then we know that the site collection has not even been attempted to be created yet, and now it's time to create it. So we're going to set the creating status to creating, and then we are going to invoke the method in the CSOM util to actually create the site collection. As you can see, we pass in the client context and the site creation properties we need to create that site collection. We pass in the URL, the owner, the template we wish to use, the title, and then all the other different values that allow us to configure quotas and the time zone for that particular site collection. If we get an error, we set the status equal to fail. Returning to the O365 Site Provisioning Controller class, we now check to see if the status is created. We know it's not. We know it's set to creating because we just set it as such as we created the site collection. So we won't jump into this if statement, nor this if statement at this point in time. Then we're going to take a break by telling the thread to sleep for a minute, and the while loop will again continue to execute. It will then look to see if the site collection has been created or if it has failed, and it will update the web page with the appropriate message. Finally, once the site collection has been created, we'll set the message accordingly. We will break out of the while loop, and then we will come back and we will establish the client context for the site collection that we have just created. At that point, we are done creating our private site collection and we can move in to provisioning our information architecture. Now we need to establish our private site collection context so we can create the information architecture and the components within the private site collection we just created. You can see we are now up to this phase in our overall stage one provisioning process. Authenticating to the private site collection again uses the Authentication Helper class. In this scenario, we use the Git Demo Site Client Context Async method to establish that client context. If I hop back over to Visual Studio and I go to the Authentication Helper, here you can see where we had the admin site client context method that we used to establish that client context. Here's the demo site client context. The only difference here is we are passing in the demo site resource ID and that site collection's URL. Everything else that flows after that through the Git SharePoint client context async method is exactly the same. It's just we are retrieving the client context for our demo site instead. Now that we have that client context established, as I mentioned, we can move forward and create the information architecture. There are many different steps associated with this, including creating site columns, content types, lists, and then binding those lookup fields. There are a few different classes that we use to do this. We've seen the classes before. Again, it is the siteprovisioning.cs class and the csomutil.cs class as well. The remove site components method is going to be fired first during the provisioning process. This method is going to call the remove SharePoint list, remove content type, and remove site columns methods in the csomutil class. This will remove the list, content types, and the site columns, so we're starting fresh every time and we don't run into any issues where we have duplicate lists, content types, or site columns that could screw up our information architecture. After we've cleaned the system, we then call the add site components method to call, which in turn calls the create site columns, create content type, add SharePoint list, and bind lookup field methods multiple times inside of the csomutil class, which is in turn going to create the site columns, content types list, and bind our lookup fields to our lists. As you will see, the site columns are defined in the underscore site columns string array in the site provisioning class. You could also store site column definitions inside of an XML file or any other type of data structure you wish to store that information you need to create your information architecture. Moving back to Visual Studio, let's take a look at the code that actually creates our information architecture. So as we saw, we have finished creating the private site collection, and the next thing that's going to happen is we're going to make our information architecture. So for our site provisioning tasks phase, we're now going to update that and say we're provisioning the information architecture so we can track it as that page periodically refreshes to provide the user information about what's happening at this point in time. As I mentioned, the remove site components method is first fired to clean everything up. So if we go take a look at this method in our site provisioning class, you can see, as I mentioned before, that we use the CSOM util class to remove our SharePoint lists, to delete our content types, and to remove our site columns. There's really nothing special that you probably haven't seen before if you're used to SharePoint development as we look at these different methods. If we take a look at remove SharePoint list method here, you will see that we are calling into a get list by title method, which essentially passes in the title and the client context and returns us the list. Here, we then delete the list object and we execute the query on the client context to remove the list. The next thing that happens is we remove content types, and we have our content types IDs specified right here. If we go look at remove content type, it's the same type of thing. We use the CSOM to return our content type, we delete it, and then we execute the query. Again, nothing really groundbreaking there in terms of SharePoint CSOM code that you probably haven't already seen before if you're familiar with SharePoint development. Finally, we remove the site columns. And this one is a little bit more complicated, but essentially what it is doing is it is going through all of the different the fields that we have defined, and it is removing them one by one by using the CSOM and getting rid of the site columns inside of the site collection. So after we start with this clean slate, then what we're going to do is add the site components. So the first time through when you run this, remove site components isn't going to really do anything because it's not going to return any of those components and then delete them because they do not exist yet. Add site components though, the first time we run it, is definitely going to be performing operations to create our different site columns and then our content types and our SharePoint lists. As you can see, we've hard-coded all the different values we have here for this particular sample. But as I mentioned before, you could also put these into an XML file or another type of data storage mechanism that you use to define your information architecture. We chose to do it like this for the sample to make one less layer in the sample and make it very consistent in the sample so it's easy to debug and make adjustments. So, creating site columns, content types, adding SharePoint lists, you can see these are commented and they happen for each list and library that we need to create throughout the site. Some of them we need to bind lookup fields to, so we pass in the information associated with the lookup fields that we're creating. Notice we have the SL underscore prefix on all of our site columns that we have created so that you can easily differentiate them from the columns that come with SharePoint. So this is where we do the heavy lifting to create all of the different information architecture components within the site. After we've deployed and created all the lists, site columns, content types, and bound everything up, we now can change our site provisioning task message to indicate that that is done and that we are going to proceed to provision the workflows. And the workflow process may take several minutes, so be patient and again, do not refresh the page during this process. So let's jump into the overview on how we create and configure workflows now. Creating and configuring workflows is the last part of the remote provisioning stage one to create our SharePoint site foundation. This is a pretty involved process. It involves the workflowutil.cs and workflowprovisionService.cs classes. It also uses the incident.xaml workflow. You can see those located with the red arrows in the Solution Explorer here. The incident.xaml file in the workflows folder defines the workflow. The remove incident workflow and related lists method is called first in this process to unsubscribe any existing workflows that have been deployed by this sample, delete the workflow definitions, and associate the workflows to the lists. The provision incident workflow and related lists method first reads the incident XAML file, and it calls the save definition and publish method to save the workflow definition and publish the workflow to the site collection. Then, the create task list and create history list methods are called to create the workflow task and history lists that the workflow relies upon. The subscribe method then subscribes the incident workflow to the item added event on the incidents list and configures the workflow to use the tasks and history lists that we just provisioned. So let's jump into the code and take a look at how these things actually occur under the hood. Now let's take a look at how this all works under the hood. So returning to Visual Studio, we've finished provisioning our information architecture, and now it's time to provision the workflow. The first thing we'll do is we will mark our phase as provision workflow so we can update the status and let the user know what's happening. The next thing that we need to do is we need to create a string to map a path to our incident.xaml workflow file so that we can provision it. And then we need to get the URL to the particular website where we are executing this request at. After that is done, we will be able to deploy the workflow to the SharePoint private site collection. As I mentioned, before we try to deploy any workflow, though, we want to remove anything that we may have deployed with this sample ahead of time so we don't get duplicates or run into collisions on things already existing. So the remove incident workflow and related lists method is first invoked. If we go take a look at this method, you will see it's in the siteprovisioning.cs class. The first thing we're going to do is get a handle on the incidents list where we register the workflow. After we get a hold of the incidents list, we're going to create a new instance of the workflow provision service class that we created. This is a helper class that allows us to do provisioning activities with workflows. And we're going to pass in the client context associated with the private site collection to do so. As you can see, when we instantiate the workflow provisioning service, we set the property for the client context, and then we establish a new workflow services manager. The workflow services manager is part of the APIs that come with SharePoint, and it requires us to pass in the client context and the web associated with the site we wish to interact with the workflow services manager with. Returning to the remove incident workflow and related lists item, after we have that workflow service manager or provision service class created, now we can call the methods on it to first unsubscribe the workflow, delete the workflow definitions, and then delete the lists associated with the workflow. So let's take a look at the unsubscribe method to start. The unsubscribe method takes in the ID for the list we wish to unsubscribe, as well as the subscription name for that workflow. The workflow services manager is going to be used to return the get workflow subscription service. So now we have the subscription service we can work with, and then we can return all of the workflow subscriptions for the incidents list. We will then load those subscriptions, and then we will go through those subscriptions, and if we find one that matches the subscription name that we specify as part of this code sample, we will delete it and execute the query. So that unsubscribes that workflow from that list. Then we need to clean up the workflow definitions for the incident list. So if we look at this particular method, again, we get the workflow deployment service. We enumerate all the definitions of workflows that have been deployed, and we load them via a CSUM call. We then loop through them, find the one that matches our workflow definition associated with the one we deploy in this code sample, and we delete it, and we're done with that part. The next thing we're going to do is we're going to delete the task and history list, and this method gets called two times, and we just pass in the names of each one of those lists. And here we're just using simple CSOM code to return the list and delete it. So after we've cleaned up everything and our workflow and everything associated with it are removed, now we can provision the incident workflow and the related lists. As I mentioned before, we got a handle on the workflow file that we're going to deploy, the incident.xaml file, as well as the URL where we'd like to deploy it. And we're going to pass in the dispatcher name as well, because we're going to use that as we provision that incident workflow. Let's take a look at the incident workflow real quick. The incident workflow is used to handle the Contoso property management company working with an incident that has been reported on a property. So initially, when an incident is found, it is going to be set to pending assignment, and we will create a task in the task list, and we will assign that to the dispatcher to assign it to a repair person. Once they have assigned it, the repair is assigned to the repair person, and then they go and repair it. After they repair it, they submit it for approval. When it is submitted for approval, the task is then reassigned to the dispatcher, who has to approve it. If they approve it, it moves to repair approved. If they reject it, it moves back to submit approval again, where the repair is pending approval, and the repair person will then have to interact with it. So as you can see, it's a pretty simple workflow. It's essentially an approval workflow with different task routing in it, and it writes to the workflow task list and the history list throughout its life cycle. All of the code that interacts with the workflow happens inside of the code inside of the Office 365 web app, as well as inside of the mobile app for the repair app. So as we come back to our site provisioning controller and we actually go into our provisioning code now, let's take a look at how this method works. The first thing we're going to do is get a handle on the incidents list again, because this is the list where we wish to attach our workflow. We're going to create the workflow provision service class again, just like we did above. And pass in the client context associated with the demo site collection where we will provision this workflow. The next thing that we're going to do is we're going to open up that workflow file in this line, and we're going to look for the suite level at web app URL placeholder, and we're going to replace it with the URL to the web app where this will be deployed. We're going to do the same thing for the dispatcher. This allows us to use a single workflow file and tailor it to each individual tenancy it is deployed to. Then what we will do after we have that incident workflow file created and edited, we are going to use the workflow provisioning service save definition and publish method. We're going to pass in the incident list, as well as this very interesting piece right here, workflowutil.translateWorkflow. What this method does is it essentially reads in the XAML from our incidents file, and it goes through the expression translator, which comes out of Microsoft Activities.Design.ExpressionTranslator namespace. And it's going to read in that XAML, and it's going to return a result. Essentially, when we get this result back, if we have no errors inside of it, then we're going to create the XAML string necessary to deploy that workflow to the SharePoint site collection. The create XAML string here uses a string builder, and it goes through the process of transforming what was in the XAML workflow to the string we need to actually deploy it to the SharePoint private site collection. So this is a very clever approach that you can use to deploy workflows without doing any editing to the code in the XAML file and making it work across multiple tenancies. After we've translated that workflow, we call the save definition and publish method. This method is going to create a new workflow definition for the client context, which is the private site collection. It's going to set the display name, and there is that translated XAML that we just saw the code for. Then we're going to call the Workflow Services Manager to get the workflow deployment service back, and we will save our workflow definition. We'll invoke the CSOM to make all those things happen, and now we have saved the workflow definition to the private site collection, and now we can in turn call the publish definition. This is going to actually publish that workflow definition to the SharePoint private site collection. So at this point, your workflow is ready to go, and it can now be hooked up to lists inside of the SharePoint site. The next thing we're going to do is we're going to create the task list, our incident workflow tasks, and our history list so that we can use them to write workflow information to. Finally, we're going to call our workflow provision service subscribe method. We're going to give the workflow a name. We're going to pass in its definition ID, the IDs for the lists, the event type that we would like to subscribe to. In this case, it's the item added event type, as well as the task list and the history list. So the subscribe method looks like this. The subscribe method essentially is going to create a workflow subscription event type. It's going to go through that. And it's going to loop through it until it finds the one that correlates to the adding type that we passed in and return it. Then we will create the workflow subscription by using the workflow subscription class and passing in the client context associated with the private site collection. Here, all the arguments that we passed into this method are used to actually create this workflow subscription on that particular list. The next thing we'll do is we'll set the properties for its task list and its history list, and then we will call the Workflow Service Manager to get the workflow subscription service, and then we will publish the list for this particular list that we're targeting, the incidents list, and we will pass in the subscription. Then when we execute the CSOM code, now our workflow has been successfully subscribed to the incidents list, registered for the item added method, and hooked up to the task and history list. So as I mentioned before, this is a pretty involved process to deploy a workflow, but the way that we've written this code, you can reuse this over and over and just change the arguments to point it toward your workflows and your tenancy. And it should be very quick for you to ramp up and use the same exact pattern to deploy workflows in your own applications. We've now reached the end of the first stage in provisioning everything for our SharePoint private site collection. In part two of this video series, I will walk through remote provisioning stage two on how we provision SharePoint data, Office 365 Video Portal, Azure Active Directory Users and Groups, and the Office 365 Groups. If you wish to learn more about this provisioning process or this particular code sample, please see these Build 2015 sessions. The first one is called Integrating Web Apps with Office 365. In this session, Doreen Brown and I describe how we got started to actually build the web app and the different things that it does. We also have the iOS and Android apps with Office 365 session, which I co-presented with Josh Gavant from Microsoft. In this session, Josh and I show how we integrate iOS and Android apps with the pieces of the puzzle that we deployed as part of this code sample. You can learn more about Office 365 developer patterns and practices at the URL you see here. There are many different samples to learn from, including the one that you're learning about right now. If you wish to get started with development for Office, you can go to dev.office.com where you can sign up for a free developer account, explore the different APIs, and see additional training about other things you can do with Office 365 as well. We welcome your feedback about this sample. You can share your feedback in the Office 365 network about this sample. If you look in there, you'll see that I do answer questions related to this sample for folks who need help with it or want to learn more about it. You can also make suggestions in user voice. If you have ideas on how to improve the provisioning process or the Office 365 technologies, and you can also go to Stack Overflow to talk to developers worldwide about questions you have about these technologies. Thanks for watching part one of this two-part series, and tune in for part two, where I will walk through stage two of everything we remote provision as part of the Property Management Code Sample.